In today's episode, we have a great interview with Josiah Smeltzer, a good friend of mine who's a veteran of the real estate world. He has his own book, a successful real estate podcast, and among many others, he's been a guest on the main Bigger Pockets podcast twice. In today's episode, Josiah talks about going from working for Olive Garden in Monroe, Louisiana, to having $50,000 a year in cash flowing rentals in the Dallas area that he turned into a $600,000 a year cash flowing business in the Tennessee area. Plus, he dives into his new adventure that took him to LA recently to sit down with a person worth close to $1 billion. And I think you're going to enjoy this episode as much as we did while recording it. If you have not yet, please subscribe so you don't ever miss an episode. And as always, if you can send a link to a friend, we would be forever grateful. And now all that is left is for someone to ring that bell.
You got to kind of put yourself in the room to be successful. Put yourself in the room with the people that are more successful than you. And if you're not going to allow yourself that, it's going to be a lot harder on you. But my first vacation rental deal, my first year, it was my cash on cash return was over 100%.
Yeah. Wow.
You are now listening to the Real Estate Heavyweights Podcast.
You see this guy here staring back at you? That's your toughest opponent. Every time you get into the ring, that's who you're going against. I believe that in boxing, and I do believe that in life.
Your weekly deep dive into DFW real estate, life, and beyond. With your hosts, Tavis Westbrook and Ashton Hines.
Well, good morning and welcome to another episode of the Real Estate Heavyweights Podcast, an interview edition. And man, I can't tell you how excited I am for this specific interview. The guy that we have on today is a good friend. He actually is probably the reason that this podcast exists, the sort of pushed me down the road to even want to do this. But we've known each other for a long time. We kind of lost touch there for a few years, but he's just a really great guy. He's done a ton in the real estate business, and I'm excited for him to be here. And we want to welcome Josiah Smeltzer. What's up, Josiah?
Hey, man, it's so cool to be here, man. I know Cindy Murray is smiling down on this.
Yeah. So I'll give a little background. So Josiah and I was trying to think of the years. We probably 15 years,
maybe 2008, 2009, yeah. Something like that.
So probably 15-ish, 16 years. We crossed paths. I worked for a nonprofit in Northern Louisiana, Monroe, West Monroe. It's called the Center for Children and Families. I was the director of the Children's Advocacy Center. We did interviews with kids, 250 interviews a year, kids that had been abused. They brought them to our place. We facilitated those interviews. And so that was my division. Josiah, he came through, and I don't even know that you had a specific job at first. I think Cindy just met you and said, we just have to have this guy on staff. I don't know what you're going to do yet, but we just have to have you around. That's how it happened, right?
She had somebody leave that was doing some financial work for her. And I had just trained at Olive Garden. I had moved down there because I was dating Sarah at the time, so we could be in the same place, you know, and I'd gotten a job at Olive Garden. I'd literally been there 2 weeks, and Cindy met me and was talking to me about my background. And she's like, oh, we just had somebody leave. We could use your help, you know, doing financial stuff. And it was like 10 times the pay that I was making at Olive Garden. So I was like, all right, see you guys.
Yeah.
I'm sure my trainer was really happy at that. Yeah.
Well, you were way over qualified for Olive Garden, you know, so, but yeah, so we worked together for, I don't know, probably close to a year at the Center for Children and Families. And, and then you kind of went off and did your thing, and we lost touch a little bit there for a while. And so why don't you just, you know, we don't have to go. So I will tell everyone this. Josiah, he has quite the repertoire of interviews out there. He's been on a bunch of podcasts, specifically one of the Bigger Pockets podcasts. You know, he was interviewed a couple of times during the COVID era, and he had his own podcast, has his own podcast, is super successful. So a lot of his story is out there. So I want to touch on it, but we don't have to dwell on all the details. But give us just the quick rundown as to sort of after you left the Center for Children and Families, you know, what brought you over to Texas and kind of what got you to where you are now?
Yeah. Long story short, I bounced around trying different jobs that never seemed to really fit. I just, you know, I kind of started getting the feeling like I wasn't a good fit for the 9-to-5 world. I just felt pretty frustrated with that, you know, the sitting in a cubicle all day thing. So I started, you know, I always was really interested in real estate. And so I started trying to figure out how I could free myself from the 9-to-5 experience, and I felt stuck in my 9-to-5. I know there's people out there that are not stuck in a 9-to-5. I'm not telling you to leave your 9-to-5 if it's a great thing for you. I'm just telling you my experience. Yeah. So I started trying to figure out how could I get out of this? And it was like, okay, I could do a startup. I could buy real estate. I could, you know, it was all these things. And I toyed around with startups and I had a lot of fun with that, but it's a lot higher rate of failure in that. And I got my graduate degree. And then after grad school, I had gotten my appraisal license and helped a friend start a real estate appraisal company. So, and at the same time, I got my real estate license so I could help people buy and sell homes as well. And that got me in the game. So I started learning how to value real estate and I bought a house. I did a live-in burr property, like a live-in flip, essentially. I bought it, fixed it up, rented it to my friends, stayed there more than 2 years, and then sold it. And I made more money than I'd ever made in my life doing that. So it was like a house hack. Before, I never even heard of Bigger Pockets. This was like, you know, 2004, 2005. And I was doing appraisal all over Dallas, Fort Worth. And I loved it. I mean, I was working for myself. I'd helped my friends start our appraisal business. I was in my 20s. And I went from that stuck in a cubicle to like wearing blue jeans and a baseball hat every day and driving all over town looking at real estate. And I just loved it. And so that kind of got me in the game. And then I did a flip and that worked out. And I took a break and went and hiked the Appalachian Trail. And during that time was when 2008 happened. So I was just happened to be out of the market at just the right time. So I got really lucky with that. But I was doing appraisals up until that time. And so I saw all that stuff like kind of building up, like people doing these refinances on homes they had just bought, pulling 100, 200 grand out of something they bought 3 months ago or trying to. And we would have people call us at our appraisal business and they would say, hey, I've got an appraisal. These would be loan officers. I got an appraisal. I need it to make this value. Can you make this value? And we'd be like, that's not really how this works. And they would hang up and they would call another appraiser until they found somebody that would do it. And a lot of those appraisers lost their licenses after that, because after 08 happened and all those properties went into foreclosure, they started looking at the appraisals and these appraisals that were inflated, they wanted somebody to blame. So they went after the appraisers. So
Tavis, you weren't calling, y'all were working in the same market at the same time. So I hope Josiah's voice doesn't sound familiar to you, because you were
this guy Tavis called me every day.
No, you know, what's interesting about that is I saw that happening around me and I ended up getting, you know, it was exciting because I'm only a couple years in, but, and mind you, I started seeing this happen. Oh gosh, it was probably 2006, 2007. I was getting opportunities to list these properties that had this happen to them. So I was getting $1 million listings, you know, as, you know, an agent 1 to 2 years in the business, and they were up in McKinney and they weren't very old homes, but this happened. And I was always like, what's going on? Of course, I was excited about listing this property, but, you know, there was just all these kind of gray areas. And I was like, what happened? And that's exactly what it was. But it was the end user or the person that owned it had already refied it, already pulled the cash. And, you know, they had like tenants living in them or, you know, furnish finder or not furnish finder, what do they call them? I forget the name, but it's basically like somebody that occupies the home and furnishes it and basically pays a really discounted rate because they're kind of living in it with their furnishings. Castle keepers and things like that. But I would list them and they were priced high and I would try to talk to them about price reductions, et cetera. And then, you know, it didn't take long and banks started calling me. And so when the banks started calling me, it was like, wait, what's going on? And yeah, they're like, yeah, they're not paying their payments and yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, oh crap. I have no idea, man. I'm just a listing agent.
Yeah. I learned from that by watching these other folks like just go so hardcore on real estate that it ended up ruining them financially. And so I applied that in so flash forward to, I guess it was 2017. I was a finance professor for a couple years at a university. I was teaching real estate there. My real estate class was my favorite class. And I started listening to Bigger Pockets, and I started doing real estate deals on the side. I had an investor come to me that was a good friend. He had $200,000 and he'd had a really good year in sales. And he's like, I know nothing about real estate, but I want to own real estate. And he's like, I don't want to lose my money. He's like, I'm pretty scared, honestly, to do it by myself. And I was like, well, I don't have any money, but I feel like I know how to do it. So maybe we could figure out a way to work together. So we came up with this plan of he would put in the money. We would form an LLC 50-50 on everything. And I would pay him back every penny of the money he put in before I ever got a penny of profit. And so I started Running Point doing the BRRRR strategy, just finding distressed properties, buying them we started off using bank financing and our equity. And then that gradually moved to using hard money and private money so we could keep all of our money in our bank. And when you're using 100% of other people's money, it obviously opens everything up for you, because now you can buy any good deal you find as long as you've got enough equity in the bank to get things like utilities turned on and other miscellaneous expenses like that. And also to obviously service the interest payments on those things. But so we started doing the BRRRR strategy, and I was doing it while I was working. Well, this like first deal we got, it was like we gained $70,000 after the refi. Hmm. And it was like, wow, this is crazy. But the only problem was we were in Little Rock, Arkansas. And we did this two or three more times, and it worked on all of them. We were getting properties and they were cash flowing and we were gaining equity. But we were like, I said, my only problem with this is I'm not certain how much the Little Rock market is going to appreciate over the next 5-10 years. I feel like it's just going to kind of bump along. So we started looking at other markets. We looked at Nashville. We looked at Huntsville, Alabama, and we looked at Fort Worth. And the problem with Huntsville was we couldn't find enough properties. Like, we couldn't get the volume we wanted to get. The problem with Nashville was it was already so high priced there that we felt like we were kind of too late. It was kind of like Austin, Texas, you know? When we looked at Fort Worth, I was like, the prices haven't gone crazy. There's a lot of properties out there. There's a lot of volume. So I think this seems like a good place for us. So that's kind of what we focused in on, is like, I did appraisal in Dallas, Fort Worth for 5 years. So I feel like I know those areas really well. And so the next 5 years, we just bought as many distressed properties as we could, did the BRRRR strategy. Some of them we would get all of our money back. Some of them we'd leave $5,000 to $10,000 in. And that's important for your audience. Like, if you're doing the BRRRR strategy, you can absolutely count on the fact that you're going to lock some of your own money in the deals. Like, don't think you're always going to get all your money back, because you'll be surprised. And sometimes you got to leave some capital in there. But, you know, when we were leaving like $10,000 in a deal, we were gaining like $70,000 to $100,000. So we were like, wow, we just did a 7X to a 10X on our equity. And then these were cash flowing. So it's like, we're cash flow positive. We're gaining a lot of equity. And then in 2021, when the values went nuts, we were looking and we were like, we're making like 50 grand a year on our portfolio. And we had millions in equity. So we were like, man, our cash on our return on equity is not really that good. So we started running some numbers, and we're like, wow, if we sell all these single families and move all this into vacation rentals, our portfolio profit will go from $50,000 a year to $600,000 a year. And so that was the best decision we ever made, is just moving that stuff over. And we used 1031 exchanges. We avoided taxes on all of it. And we were able to unlock all that equity we had built up in these BRRRR properties. So, you know, in my story, single family was a great place to start. But I think a lot of people run into the same problems. Like, you build, like, the values on the single families tend to, if you're in a good market, they'll go up quicker than your rents go up, and you end up, you know, your cash flow may be thin, but your equity is, you have a lot of equity. So the best thing, one of the options you have to unlock that is to sell those and move those over using the 1031.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you brought up a great point, because I believe that's something that, you know, was talked about a lot, right? And it's one of those things that's brought up. You hear it on Bigger Pockets conversations and stuff like that. And I've struggled with it myself with, you know, with my portfolio. And, you know, the $1 million question is, where do you move it to, right? Is okay, if you 1031 it and move it over, where does it go from there? You know, I think you got in at the right time, right? Getting into the vacation rentals the way that you did. The timeline that you're talking about, I know it was the sweet spot of doing that. But, you know, that's something that I do struggle with a little bit with some of the rental portfolio that I have is like, you know, does it make sense to move it? You know, does it make sense to try to exercise that? Now, you had a partner, right? And do you still have the same partner?
Yes. Yeah, we're still 50-50 on everything.
Got it. So
he got all his money back. That's a piece of the story I left out. About the time we moved everything over to vacation rentals, we did a refi on it. We bought a vacation rental in 2021, and in 2022, the vacation rental market just went insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys remember. And in 2022, the property we had just bought for $425 appraised for $750. Mm-hmm. And so we did a refi on that. He got all his money back.
Wow.
So and you guys are up in Tennessee, right? Mostly up in
the
Smokies?
Yeah, those are in the Smoky Mountains. Anybody that's listening to this, by the way, I'm a broker up there. And if you want to buy a vacation rental in the Smokies, like Pigeon Forge, Gatlinburg, Sevierville, I'd be happy to help you. So you can find my contact info. Yeah,
we'll definitely link all that. And for sure, definitely, yeah, definitely.
That's awesome. So going back, just curious. When you bought your rental portfolio that you had, and you were buying properties in Fort Worth, what was the number of those doors that you had at the time, and what was your source to find them? Were you buying them on MLS? Were you buying them through wholesalers? What was your, what was your target?
Yeah, so it was the number of properties we had was in constant flux because we would sell some, we were doing some flips, but we ended up with around 20. And the reason it wasn't more was because we started off, this is something else I see a lot of new investors do. We started off where most people do, which is buying the really cheap properties, right? Get a really cheap property in not the best area. It's got a, it's got a great, cash on cash return. But then you discover that it's got a lot more problems generally with managing the tenants. You have, generally higher turnover. They tear it up more, more collection problems, more crime, all that stuff. So we kind of gravitated towards B-class properties. And so I would say the average deal then was probably us buying it from, and we bought 95% of them from wholesalers.
Got it.
So we just networked with all the wholesalers in DFW, and we tried some direct marketing and we just didn't have a lot of success with that. And I know it was because we didn't do enough of it. So I know that works, but you got to kind of in real estate, you got to kind of choose what you want to do. And it's like the one thing, the book, the one thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, you can't be great at every piece of this whole thing. So you got to kind of choose what you want to do and go with it and kind of let, the people that are great at direct mail and all that, like that's their thing. Like, we wanted our thing to be building our portfolio and not as much concern with the direct mailer stuff. So we just got we built really good connections with the wholesalers, and like, we were happy for them to make some money on their deal as long as we could come close to refinancing and getting all of our capital back. So, I would say, well, one of the takeaways from that was sometimes instead of trying to make the maximum profit from a deal, trying to be the direct mailer and get the most equity and the most everything, sometimes you're trading progress for the potential profit of something that never comes. So instead of trying to be, the direct mailer who's getting the 100K equity, but you don't know that you're going to actually be able to do it because you don't have that business going. That's a business, Maybe you should be okay with taking the 50K like base hit and get yourself a bunch of properties and some momentum. And then we got more capital, you can focus on that other thing.
Yep.
So yeah.
Yeah, we're going through that right now. Tavis and I I'm trying to push towards maybe hiring a cold caller or something like that. Mark Fuller's been on the podcast. He has a great direct mail business. And so, yeah, it's from my perspective is, on the other side, you have your wholesalers, you have your realtor business. I kind of want to have some sort of control over the flow. If you can figure that piece out, I can sort of feed myself forever as opposed to having to sort of wait around for someone to bring the good deal to it. Now, from your side of it, though, if you really go all in, and Tavis has done a great job over the years of developing realtor a base that comes to him and says, hey, I have a deal. If you did the same with wholesalers and find those really good wholesalers and say, look, you just bring me stuff, I'll be your guy, I think that could work out really, really well too. So we're going through some of that conversation.
And that's right basically now. What Josiah is saying. I mean, the mailers work the same way, right? If that's your business model and you're really good, like Mark Fuller is, you know, he's got that oiled machine. That's a business model that works for him. Yeah. It's worked for him for the last 15 years. And that's where he's able to go through them. He's got several of them. He's piping, you know, $10,000 a month into that business that, you know, to run it. And then he's getting, you know, so many leads and so many phone calls and, you know, and they turn into contracts. Yeah, you know?
For sure. So let's talk a little bit about, so I know they're in, when you transitioned over to short term, talk a little bit about the overall net benefit of owning a short term rental, specifically in an area that is vacation driven. It's not sort of a one-off house in the middle of, you know, Richardson that you know, you could have some short-term traffic, but you are built, that area is built with a system and cleaners and management, all that around vacations. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, some of the tax benefits and just the overall cash flow benefits that you found once you moved over into that market?
Yeah. So the biggest benefit for us was being able to scale our portfolio, and then the cash on cash return was ridiculous. I mean, you know, we went from on our single families, you know, some of the deals were better than others, but I mean, I would say the average single family was like, I would guess it was like 20% cash on cash return, something like that. And then I told Ashton this before, and I don't want everybody to expect this on their vacation rentals, but my first vacation rental deal, my first year, it was my cash on cash return was over 100%.
Wow.
So, and I bought and another really cool, like, perk to doing vacation rentals is if you're buying like a cabin, you can buy it as a second home. And so you can put 10% down on it. And so, you know, you can buy a large property, which gives you that depreciation potential in the million. So, you know, let's say your first deal is $1 million. You're only putting $100,000 down. Well, your depreciation, you know, and they're looking at reinstating the bonus depreciation at 100%, which would be great. But, you know, when I was first doing this, that first year, you know, you're able to take a massive chunk of depreciation on that property. And so, you know, we had just moved. I mentioned this. We had gone from 50,000 to 600,000 mm-hmm. profit. So now I've got 300,000 profit coming in every year that I got to figure out what to do for the tax liability on. Yep. So the best part about it was we unlocked the equity, moved it into the vacation rentals. The cash on cash went way up. So we were making well over 20%. So that metric was better. And then our depreciation base went way up. So we didn't pay any taxes for years. So we were able to take all that income and then it even trickled down to our personal income and sheltered that as well. So it provided, like, we went from on the single family, which you can depreciate single families, but our portfolio went from, you know, we had 20, I would say the average was $250,000 value. So we had $5 million with the houses. We went from that to now we've got 57 bedrooms. So a lot of these are like 12 and 11 bedroom cabins. So I don't even know right now what the depreciation base is, but it was multiples of the 5 million. I would say maybe like 15 to 20 million now mm-hmm. currently. So much more depreciation. So the tax benefits were massive and then the income so good. And we ended up the business, we built a business, right? It's not no longer just like us with these rentals. We hired a guy that's managing these for us now. We managed them ourselves for a while. And then these are all on Airbnb and VRBO. And then we hired a guy in-house that manages them for us because with how many, you know, we have so many bedrooms that if we were paying somebody 10%, we'd be paying a lot more in management expense. So we're paying more like 4 or 5% on our portfolio. And the management's really good. So our reviews are great and we get lots of bookings and that business is doing great. You heard all this negative stuff about vacation rentals, you know, over the last 6 months. And I know that some regulations changed in places like Dallas and New York City. That's more like houses that people are Airbnb. Like
I was going to say, I wouldn't categorize that vacation rental at that point.
That's
right?
Not vacation rental. That's more like, yeah. But this stuff is more vacation. Like you're going to the Smoky Mountains, staying in a cabin, have fun with your family for a week and then leave kind of thing. It's a different business than renting your house in Nashville out.
Right. Well, in the Smokies, you know? I think you've told me, or maybe Aaron, who's also doing a midterm here, he owns one up in the Smokies, one of our investors. I think there's something like 13 million visitors a year to that, the Smoky Mountain National Park. And I think he was telling me there's the same number of cabins or similar number of cabins in the Smokies as there are over in Broken Bow. I mean, that's a really saturated market right now. Yeah. And, well, and so there's just a lot of options up there.
And your season's pretty flexible, right? You don't really have like a, you know, you know, like for instance, a beach house, right? For instance, will have a season that it's more open than others, and something like that up there. You pretty much have a year-round season, right?
Yes, that, you know, when we were looking at doing this, moving from single family into vacation rentals, we first thought, I mean, first thing we thought of was the beach, because that's like, well, when you think vacation, most people immediately think of the beach. Well, when we did some research, we found that, you know, the majority of the income on those properties comes in like the summer months, June, July, you know. And if you have something bad happen in the summer, like you're wrecked.
I was going to say, then insurance.
yeah.
The insurance factors that come along with a beach property. Yeah.
Exactly. And so we looked at the Smokies and it was like the cash flow is very like stable, you know, and you do have busier times, like the summertime is really busy. Mm-hmm. I mean, there'll be times in the summer where June and July, for instance, where we don't have one vacant day in any cabin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
for those entire month, those 2 months. Now, February is the slowest month of the year up there. We just came out of February. But yeah, it's much more stabilized cash flow than the beach is, at least the beach where I looked. I looked in at the beaches in Alabama, you know.
Plus your salt water is tearing your house up. You know, you don't have nearly as much probably CapEx up there, you know,
sand.
You
would
in sand, sand all in your plumbing, you know, everyone there. So, did you have another question about the Smokies there, Chad?
I did just from a dynamic of trading up. So, you went from 20 doors and what I find interesting now, I love it. But now you're talking bedrooms. So you went from doors, whole house, single family units to now talking bedrooms, right? Which is amazing. But from a unit perspective, right? From a door, it sounds like you said you have like 57 bedrooms and you said the average are about 12 bedroom unit. So I would assume you're somewhere in the, you know, five doors, six door kind of, you know.
Yeah, we've got, I think I have seven cabins in the Smokies, and then I've got seven. These are like cabins and houses on a lake in Alabama.
Like a fishing, kind of a fishing camp type deal, right?
Yeah, fishing cabins and stuff. So, and then I've got seven. These are like cabins and houses on a lake in Alabama.
Like a fishing, kind of a fishing camp type deal, right?
Yeah, fishing cabins and stuff. So, and that's also in our business. So it's easier to break it down by bedroom because, you know, when you hear a door, well, on a cabin, you know, a door could be a two bedroom cabin or a 12 bedroom. Those are very different assets.
Sure.
You know? So, yeah. So that's, and we also break it down by bedroom because the number of bedrooms is the revenue driver.
Got
the whole thing.
Got it.
When people book a vacation, they want to know how many people they can squeeze in there.
Right.
And so they're more concerned with like how many beds does it have? And even, you know, when I say beds, I'm talking bedrooms. I'm not talking beds.
Sure, like, right. Sure.
Our 12 bedroom cabin can sleep like 55 people.
Wow. Got it.
So
got it.
Oh, Tavis, so, you could have Thanksgiving there. That's amazing.
Yeah right.
I know. Yeah, Tavis has a huge family. They have these 50, 60 person gatherings. So
yeah.
So another big question, Josiah. So you obviously looked at your books and I obviously you're in a, you know, it was a great thing to evaluate, right? Say, hey, we've got, you know, $5 million worth of, you know, $5 million worth of assets, but we're only getting 10%, you know, cash flow, right? Actually less than 10%. You're getting 1% cash flow at that point. So 1% cash flow, $50,000 a year, and then you convert that over to, you know, $600,000 a year in cash flow from that model, but you also increased equity because of the timing of when you bought it. And so you mentioned like one of the cabins you bought were, you know, under 400,000 and it's now worth, it was over 750 or something like you had mentioned.
Yes.
So in that, so what do you struggle with now? Like when you look at your portfolio now, obviously 600,000 is a great number, but obviously you have equity in those properties now too. So are you good just letting it ride for a while? Are you considering, you know, moving that over or trading up or, you know, into other areas now? Like what's the next step now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we have been looking at the, you know, the return on equity. That's really the metric I think that you need to pay the most attention to, right? Because if you're sleeping on the return on equity, then you may think, well, I did the burn strategy on this whole thing. I don't have any money in this. And you don't realize, hey, you've got $3 million of equity and you're making, you know, 30 grand a year. If you put that 3 million bucks in cabins, you could be making 250,000. So it's the same exact question now for us. You know, the cabins went up in value rapidly, but with all the rate hikes, they've come back down a little bit. So it's much harder to sell cabins right now because people are more fearful about the markets, mm-hmm. even though you can find better deals right now than you could a year ago. I bought one this last year, but the number of people calling me to buy has slowed down some because people are just seeing interest rate hikes and they're more concerned about what's going to happen. You know, so I think our loose plan right now is to keep an eye on our equity and our return on equity. And when rates come down and the values fly again, we'll probably try to do a portfolio sale and sell all this and go buy, you know, 100 unit plus apartment complexes so we can trade up again.
Got it. So, and sorry, I wanted to ask this real quick, Josiah, because we didn't bring it up before, but, you know, for instance, everybody jumped into the broken boat deal after, you know, through COVID, right? And now there's talks of it being oversaturated and being very difficult to get into. Obviously, the Smokies are much bigger and it broadcast over a lot bigger geographical location. What's your thoughts on that? Is it getting oversaturated? Is it still a good opportunity to get into something out there? Or what's your thoughts as far as 2024 goes?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that based on what I've been observing, it's not oversaturated. There are, you know, my strategy, which is what we've done, I would advise everyone, you know, look at doing this if you're going to be up there, is you want to buy well-located properties, right? Even in Broken Bow, if you buy a really well-located property, it's probably going to do okay, right? It's the ones that are built out from town that are, you know, don't have the access to the major attractions that are going to get hit the hardest. Just like, you know, well, I don't know if that's the best example. I was going to make an example. I don't know if it's the best example, but our properties are still renting out very well. The occupancy is great. Our cash flow for our portfolio is very similar to last year. So we haven't really seen any like dip with the cash flows or anything. The occupancy is good. It's stable. And there's so much vacation traffic up there that well-located properties are going to stay booked up because people want to stay close to the attractions they're going to be going to in town. So I would say, like, you know, now if they built 10x the cabins up there next year, yeah, we'd have a problem. But the fact that building costs have gone up so rapidly and then interest rates have gone up so rapidly, the building has really slowed down a lot. Gotcha. So they're not cranking out the volume of new properties they were. And so, yeah, I feel like it's pretty stable.
Can you still pay cash for something under $1 million up there?
Tavis is starting to do the math. He's doing the math for himself. He's not saying it yet, but he's doing the math.
Well, it's just, you know, it's one of those things. You ask questions of the right people.
Yeah,
right?
No. I hope you get a cabin up there.
You're saying, can you pay cash for something under $1 million?
Yeah.
Like yeah, how do you mean?
Like it price points? Is there still availability to get into a decent cabin for under $1 million up there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I tell my clients, you know, and, you know, if you listen to this podcast 2 years from now, obviously, like, you're going to need to update this. But I tell my clients, we try to find stuff at $200,000 a bedroom or less.
Got it.
You know, obviously, since rates have gone up, you know, we're looking at less than $200,000 to make it cash flow well. But, you know, you can do the math. You get a 3-bedroom cabin, you're looking at $600,000, mm-hmm. you know. So,
got it.
As you go down on bedrooms, the price per bedroom goes up. So that's why we gravitated towards buying the larger stuff. You know, we could, like, we got a 12 bedroom for like $1.8 million. So and now that's, you know, a lot of that stuff's going for over $200,000. So there's deals out there, and there's deals right now out there because people are more fearful about buying right now. And I predict that rates go down over the next 12 to 24 months. And the values on these are going to go up. So this is actually a good window to buy if you've got some money sitting there and you've always wanted to do this.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Tavis has a commercial building. He got a soft offer on. So I don't know if he's thinking about cashing out on his commercial building. He's like, oh man, let's go get a cabin.
That's, you know,
so,
it's one of those things, but I will tell you with the commercial, what's nice about it is triple net, right? So it's like, do I want to get into it, you know, roll that into another triple net situation? Cause there is something nice about when taxes and insurance go up, it's not, doesn't affect me personally, right? It goes back to the tenant. So there is something very nice about that compared to when I look at my midterm portfolio and I'm like, oh gosh, man, these expenses, you know, between taxes, insurance, and cleaning fees, you know, and I look at that, or even just my stupid AT&T internet, and internet's not bad. It's the cable, right? It's having the streaming TV options. And those numbers, I swear, like every 6 months, I just see it tick up another 10, 15 bucks. And I'm like, what do you do, man? You're stuck, you know?
Yeah. To me, the vacation rental asset class is a stepping stone.
Yeah.
You know, it's a stepping stone. It's a good intermediary between single family and commercial. And I've got a guy that's got two apartment complexes that he's got his apartment complexes under contract to sell. And he's wanting to move into vacation rentals because he wants to move down. Like he wants to have the ability to sell things off one at a time if he wants to.
Yeah.
And he thinks the cash on cash is going to be higher for him in this. So, you know, there's perks to it, but I would definitely say, like, for me, like I hope in the next 5 to 10 years, I can bundle this stuff up and sell it because it's served its purpose for us. And now, you know, we were talking about this earlier. I need to unlock the equity that's there and trade that up again.
Yeah.
So
cool. It makes sense.
Something like apartments, if not apartments, like self storage or something like that.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's kind of where I was going to go next with your experience with your podcast is super successful and you've had the opportunity to interact with different masterminds and different, you know, I know you have a couple investors there in Alabama that are friends that no one knows about. And so who have you met? Who have you talked to that kind of expanded your vision, you know, of what's even possible when you first started out? And you, I'm sure, you know, when and most people start out, they don't think, well, I'm gonna own an apartment. But in knowing, talking to you, like your vision for what you want to do, not just in real estate, but just for people in general, humanity. I mean, we didn't get into the fact that you have a huge heart for people. You grew up in a missionary family. You want to use real estate to kind of be this springboard into really making a difference with people. And it's a vehicle, but it's not everything for you. You know, so who have you met? What are a few of the lessons that has kind of expanded your vision for what's even possible?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when you're trying to do big things, you're trying to kind of take a step out and conquer limiting beliefs. Like you have to first believe in yourself. You have to like be able to look in the mirror and say, I can do this, even when you don't know all the steps to get there. And so, and that's kind of like a step in faith by itself. So you gotta kind of put yourself in the room to be successful, put yourself in the room with the people that are more successful than you. And if you're not going to allow yourself that, it's going to be a lot harder on you. So, you know, I would say like the first thing I did was just say, I want to do something different than the 9-to-5 route. And then it was like reading every book I could get. And it was a podcast. And that's one way you can surround yourself with people that are doing much more scale wise than you're doing. Is I just immerse myself in Bigger Pockets. I listen to every episode. Some episodes I listen to multiple times. And I got involved any way I could. And I ended up having Brandon Turner on my podcast. He invited me to the first real estate mastermind down there in Hawaii. I go down there. Well, I became friends with Ryan Pineda. He was like sitting next to me and Brandon and then Brian Murray. And I developed friendships with people like those guys. And, you know, like guys like Brian, you know, I was friends with Brian before they did the Open Door Capital thing. Like they started Open Door Capital. They raised $100 million in a year to buy multifamily. So when you see people doing stuff like that, you're like, what's my limiting belief? Why do I think I can't do as much as these guys? Mm-hmm. They're working hard. They're smart. But they've also put in the time and the reps to network and get to know all these people. And they didn't just start with that level of success. They worked and were creative in their approach to everything. But I don't know if I'm answering your question, but basically the answer is like, you got to be willing to put yourself in the room with people like that.
Yeah.
Learn from them. And then also realize you're different than them. You have your own giftings that you can use to reach your same goal. And your path journey is not going to be the exact same as Brandon Turner's or Brian's. Your journey is going to be yours. Yeah. And, you know, Tavis, you were talking about, you know, looking at your properties and equity and how to unlock the equity and what to do. Like, this is a different environment right now than it was in 2021 when we were looking at doing this. Mm-hmm. So now you might have a portfolio at 4% and you're like, wow, I've got all this equity, but if I trade it up, I got to trade it for 7.5% stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, that might not make a lot of sense. So it's like, my story may not be the same as somebody else's. You know what I mean? So I would just say, like, how do you get to know those people? By any means necessary, like
right,
immerse yourself in podcasts, meetups, you know, networking events. Just get to know everybody you can, any way you can.
And I think the other thing, like kind of the byproduct of that, is you realize they're just normal people.
Exactly,
these are not, you know, super brilliant superhumans. A lot of these are just dudes that kind of put one foot in front of another. Sometimes got a little bit lucky. You know, but they met a guy, they knew a guy, and they put themselves in that position. But that's what's really kind of cool, is that you start talking with people that you've read their book or you've listened to them on a podcast, but then you're hearing their experience and they're just normal people. And that's one of the nice benefits of doing healthcare for a long time, is I always say, is like, it doesn't matter what kind of house I go to, what your background is. I mean, when you get home health services, you've been to the hospital, everyone's the same. You know, it's like you're going through the exact same issues and all this. We're having the same conversations about meds and all these things that are uncomfortable for people. You're just a person. And I think that is one of the nice, because then it kind of makes it real for you. Like, man, I can do this. You know, like he's a nice guy, he's smart, whatever. But, I can see myself doing this. And so I know for you, you know, Brian, if people don't know Brian Murray, you know, I don't know how many doors he owns now, but he owns thousands of apartment doors. And even before Open Door Capital, I mean, he has a cool story. He, you know, and recently he, you know, kind of got to the base camp of Everest, and he's just a really, 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 really nice guy. And Josiah and he have a great relationship. And, you know, so I know you started out with, you know, real estate, that's been your springboard, but you are kind of shifting gears a little bit. You had, you know, the Daily Real Estate Investor podcast for a long time and super successful. You're rebranding that. Kind of talk about where you see you going, what you know, in the grand scheme of things, what are you wanting to accomplish with some of these relationships you've developed? And if the next year went really, really well for you, what would it look like?
Yeah. So the podcast has been rebranded from the Daily Real Estate Investor to the Josiah Smeltzer Show. And I kind of deliberated over what to call it, but I'm really most interested in the mindset that's required to do big things, to accomplish big goals and big dreams, more so than I am one specific asset class. So the more interesting thing in real estate to me is talking about the mindset that people like Brandon had when they built Open Door Capital, and they, you know, how Brandon contacted Bigger Pockets to get the job of co-host of the Bigger Pockets podcast. Like, that's a mindset thing. You know, that had nothing to do with real estate. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a real estate show, but he wasn't using any real estate knowledge on that. So the mindset that's required to do big things is really interesting to me. So anyway, that's what the show is about now. And I'm most interested in really just making a positive impact in the world. You know, the experience of living in Africa when I was 12 with my family, seeing how people less fortunate live, how blessed we are here in the U.S. I really want to do something to impact a lot of people in a positive way. So I'm working on a YouTube channel that's more on like entertainment, adventure type experiential content. And now I want to have a second channel that is philanthropy work, nonprofit, like going into impoverished areas, helping people that need help, like bringing other people into that, you know, getting them motivated and excited about doing good things and being a light in the world. You know, you guys know, I mean, you put content out, you'll have a bunch of positive comments, and then there'll be a few in there that are just like taking cheap shots at you for no reason. It's like, there's so much of that. There's so much negativity out there. That's like, we need people on the other side that are out there putting positivity out, you know? So.
For sure. And speaking of putting yourself in the rooms with big people, your I think your first interview as the new podcast and the new channel was super impressive. You went out to LA, you sat down with a guy that makes $200 million a year, something like that. Talk a little bit about that experience, because that was really cool to watch. You know, knowing you, so just a little bit of background, Josiah and I reconnected about a year and a half ago. I reached out. Actually, I had posted a picture from the Bigger Pockets conference. And you're like, you know, I was on the podcast. I was like, no. And so I went back, I listened. I went out there and, you know, we talked about maybe teaming up and doing a podcast, and it just didn't quite jive on that one. And I knew you had this vision for something bigger and something a little bit outside of real estate. And you had this heart for doing more just kind of with philanthropy and tying everything together. And I was at the front part of my adventure of real estate. You know, that's when I reached out to Tavis and I said, hey, you know, would you want to do a local real estate show, kind of really hyper-focused local? And it's worked out. But seeing you kind of, you know, I knew you've been having these conversations internally of like, what do I want to do? Where do I want to put my time? We have finite time. And so now that you've finally, you know, you have this vision, and the first thing you do is you fly out to LA and you're doing this interview with this guy that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm like, man, he's kind of kicking this thing off right, you know? So talk about that experience a little bit.
Yeah, well, so after you kind of started this podcast, I spent the last 9 months cranking out real estate content on my channel. It was just a lot of like shorts and, you know, that YouTube channel is going on 700 subscribers now, but I also spent a lot of time trying to figure out, okay, what do I want to do? Cause I feel like I'm becoming less and less interested in only real estate content, more and more interested in, you know, things like, How do I impact a million people with charity kind of stuff, you know? And it's that's a luxury to be in that place. And it's because of real estate that I'm there. You know what I mean? So, but I'm like trying to figure out, okay, if I build a channel, what kind of content do I need to make to impact the most people, have the largest reach to be able to build the nonprofit the way I have envisioned? Yeah. So on this episode with Edwin Ariave, which I love people to check it out. My YouTube channel is just my name, Josiah Smelser. But I saw him on Erwin McManus podcast. I think it's called Mindshift. And this guy, Erwin McManus, is a pretty famous minister. But he used to work in like homeless ministries and whatnot. But he ended up planting a church in L.A., which is like the craziest place to plant a church. Because he felt like that's the place he needed to go. He felt like that was a very unchurched place. But he started a church out in L.A., and his podcast is awesome. But he does a lot of work with people on, like, mindset, overcoming limiting beliefs, a lot of kind of similar stuff to what I'm wanting to do. Anyway, I was watching his podcast and heard Edwin's story and was just, like, blown away with this guy, you know, because he basically was born in poverty, you know, overcame his parents being in jail, getting hauled out to jail when he was a kid, a lot of, like, not believing in himself to build these companies that are making, you know, hundreds of millions a year. By my math, the guy could probably sell his businesses for over $1 billion.
Oh, yeah. Any sort of multiple. Like, yeah. I mean, you know, I think he said he made 600, his businesses have made 600 since they've been in existence. And, you know, but in the last two, he said he'll basically replicate that in 3 years. So, I mean, they're doing 200 a year.
Yeah.
So any sort of multiple.
He's done the last 12 months, he brought in 200 million. And I'm like, so, you know, I asked him off the show, I was like, so are you a billionaire? He's like, not yet. And I'm like, I don't know. but you know, the interesting thing was you were talking about how these people are just people. You know, I was down there in his house. By the way, his father-in-law is John Mellencamp.
Oh, really?
The musician.
Wow.
He's married to John Mellencamp's daughter, and she's on a reality show. So, like, he's like, you know, he and his wife are pretty famous, actually. But I mean, when I was in his house, the guy's just another guy. You know, he was nice, and you know, he was just doing stuff like everybody else I know does. And I was sitting there like, this guy's probably close to worth nearly $1 billion, and he's just a guy, just like everybody else I know, and he's approach life from a different perspective, but it's kind of like an eye-opening moment, just like, you know, maybe sitting at a real estate mastermind with Brandon Turner, or like getting your first house flip done or whatever. You're like, maybe I don't believe in myself enough. Mm. You know, maybe I need to have more faith and more belief in what I am capable of, instead of saying like, here's what I can do, and then there's a ceiling there, you know?
Yeah, that's for other people, you know, kind of reading and sort of saying like, yeah, they know some sort of magic sauce that I don't know. And then when you hear their story and you meet them, you realize like, no, it's they kind of put this together. Now, like you know, you took action and you hit some timing of the mark. Hey, I hiked the Appalachian Trail at the right time, just kind of, okay, that was nice. And, you know, but you gave yourself the knowledge base. You put one foot in front of the other. And, you know, that's the thing about, I guess the unfortunate thing about Instagram and Facebook and YouTube is you kind of see the polished version of a lot of people's journeys that took a long time to get there. You know, that's the missing part. No one really shows that part. But when you actually get to sit down with people and hear those things, you know, and you realize, I can do this. They started with one flip. Well, I just did one flip. You know, they started with one 1031. I can do a 1031. And honestly, there's a lot of people I've been working with here in the Dallas market on the and income side. They would be perfect to fit over into the, I've actually told multiple people about Tennessee. It's like, you know, you probably should look over here on the short-term rental, you know, the Airbnb over in Tennessee is just, it's a good market. They're not that far away from being able to take advantage of some of these bigger things. Yeah. That's what I love about your story. You're a great example, you know, and I knew you when we worked at a nonprofit and neither one of us were making very much money, you know, and it was Monroe, Louisiana, you know, there was no one there is getting a huge leg up on life, but, you know, just kind of finding your path and putting one foot in front of another. It's like, it just happens. 15 years later, you're doing great. You know,
one of the,
I appreciate that.
One of the quotes, you know, or statements that's out there, right? It's, you know, when you talk about money and you talk about people, you know, and I just mentioned this to my son the other day, you know, it's the conversation of money doesn't change who you are, right? It just amplifies who you are. And so, you know, it kind of goes back to what you're saying, Ashton, about people are people, right? At the end of the day, you're in a room with somebody that's just another person, but it truly, money, as you make more money, it just, you know, again, it amplifies the character of who you are. And so whether you're a bad person with no money or you're a good person with lots of money, you know, it kind of just depends on who you are, right? And what your character is and what's important to you in life. And, you know, can be used as a great tool, you know, in that sense. If you do make more money, it's just something, you know, because people talk about that all the time, regardless of who you are. You know, if you make more money or you have the limited belief, people say, I don't want to make more money because I don't want to change who I am. You know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's an opportunity to get where you want to go or reach more people or whatever your purpose is in life, you know, what your why is, you know. And I remember hearing that on your recent podcast, and we talk about that a lot, you know, but it's figuring out the why, and your why can change, and it will change over time.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Josiah, man, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being here, you know, getting to see the very beginning of the next chapter. You know, I know you've got a lot of big things. You've got a big interview coming. This is a warm-up interview for you to do, you know, another big one with Brandon. I know, you know, the idea that you're taking time with us. I joked with Josiah. I was like, you know, we'll see which podcast gives you a little bit of a bigger bump. You know, the Real Estate Heavyweights or the Brandon Turner, his podcast that he's got going now. But I appreciate you sharing your experience and your time. If you haven't had a chance, I don't know how many people out there have looked up your stuff yet. I'm going to link it and everything in social and put it out there. But if you haven't, go back and listen to some of the longer interviews. Definitely check out the YouTube channel. We'll link all that stuff. So are you going to basically do interviews on YouTube and put it on your podcast? Is that kind of how you're thinking you're going to do both channels? Or,
you know, it's all kind of in flux right now. I'm in that entrepreneurial phase where you're out testing and iterating and trying to figure out, you know, everything. But I do know that my content type is going to be the more like adventure entertaining type stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
And then the second channel is going to be philanthropy, but my podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and all that. So that stuff's going to continue to go there, the audio. So it's yet to be determined whether I'm going to keep cranking out video podcast episodes or not. Okay. Because I don't want to be spread too thin and doing too many things at once, you know?
Well, we'll link it all. Check it out. You've done a lot of really cool interviews on the podcast. You've got the new interview you did out in LA. It's awesome. And I hope you have some more kind of lined up. And if there's anything that we can do, you know, if there's anyone over here in Dallas we can help you connect with, I would love to play a part in whatever your chapter is next. And so definitely appreciate the time, all the wisdom, and we'll link everything for everybody out there, put it out on social, and definitely great luck in your new endeavor.
Same to you guys, man. I'm loving this podcast y'all are doing. Y'all keep going. You're doing an awesome job. I predict great things for you guys.
Awesome. Thanks, Josiah. We appreciate you, man.
Absolutely.
All right, you guys, all right, we'll talk to you soon.